I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
Tit-for-tat fighting between Pakistan and Afghanistan is getting worse. Taliban troops infiltrated Pakistan today. Pakistan bombed Kabul and Kandahar.
The challenge really is we're setting a precedent where neither side really knows how to back down and de-escalate.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, Turkey is running out of water and making up for empty reservoirs by pulling up groundwater is a devil's bargain.
This is The Gamble. Fill gaps to satiate thirst now or prepare for the future and save long-term stores.
And Mexico will get an official 40-hour work week, ending a disparity between blue and white-collar workers.
The fact that only blue-collar workers have one day off is, I would say, caste system.
Plus, it is Pokemon Day. We'll tell you about those stories and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. We begin with the fragile situation between Afghanistan and Pakistan. There were fierce clashes again today. Pakistan's defense minister, Khwaja Asif, wrote on X, quote, "Our cup of patience has overflowed. Now it is open war between us and you." Pakistan accuses its neighbor of becoming a proxy for India and a haven for terrorists. The two countries have been going at it for months, and today, Afghan Taliban troops stormed dozens of Pakistani border positions. The Pakistani Air Force responded with airstrikes, hitting Kandahar and Kabul. Ibrahim Bahis is a senior analyst in Kabul with Crisis Group. He explained to me why the back and forth is happening and what it felt like in Kabul overnight.
It was around 3 a.m. that we heard a loud boom and sounds of explosions here in Kabul. And there were some faint sounds of jets in the skies as well. Besides that, there were no further sounds or movement here in Kabul besides this incident that I mentioned. On social media, it became quite apparent that some likely a military installation had been targeted, although there has been no official confirmation on casualties and targets as of yet.
Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city, was also targeted. What kinds of sites were hit there, and do we know anything about casualties there?
So this is the second time that Pakistan has carried out airstrikes both in Kandahar and Kabul. The last time was in October last year, again in response to a major Taliban ground offensive, which was again in response to airstrikes by Pakistan inside Afghanistan. This time, however, the Pakistani media's messaging has been that the targets were military, both in Kandahar and Kabul. And whereas last year, for example, downtown Kabul was hit, this time it was more isolated location. So it seems that at least it was not a crowded area that was hit in these latest round, both in Kabul and in Kandahar, but rather quite possibly it could be military installations. Yet again, we cannot state with certainty because Kabul has not yet confirmed it on their end.
As you have said, this is part of a larger pattern of tit-for-tat violence. Tell us what is at the root of this conflict.
The core issue between the two neighbors stems from the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is a militant group that emerged in Pakistan around 2007.
Also known as the Pakistani Taliban, correct?
That's correct, yes. That's exactly correct. The Pakistani Taliban emerged in 2007. And since the Taliban's return to power here in Afghanistan, they have seen a huge surge in Pakistan, and the violence levels in Pakistan have spiraled and increased exponentially. Pakistan's argument is that the TTP has sanctuaries in Afghanistan, that some of their leaders, that most of their leadership and some of their membership is based in Pakistan, and they are carrying out cross-border incursions into Pakistan to carry out violence. Afghanistan's argument, on the other hand, is that the TTP is an internal Pakistani security issue, that there are very few, if any, TTP present here in the country, and that it's the responsibility of Pakistan to prevent cross-border incursions while Afghanistan's willing to offer assistance on it. It's a porous border that they cannot control themselves as well.
So just to give a little recap here, basically, Islamabad, Pakistan, says that Afghanistan is helping this insurgent group in Pakistan, so the Pakistani Taliban. Kabul, the Taliban government in Afghanistan, says, we are not. This is a internal security issue for you. Where does the truth lie between those two statements?
It's an incredibly complicated situation. Pakistan initially did not actually accuse Kabul of supporting the TTP. What they wanted the Taliban to do was crack down on the TTP. And Kabul has always resisted that call and has said that we will not embroil ourselves in other people's fights, and has always framed this as a domestic Pakistani battle that Pakistan needs to resolve with its own population. In terms of the cross-border nature, it's worth recalling this is a huge disputed border.
Some 1,600 miles.
That's correct, exactly 1,600 miles. And armed groups on both sides of the country have always been able to utilize that in order to operate. And it's been an incredibly difficult border for anyone to control, including the NATO-led international forces that operated in Afghanistan for two decades. I would say that the TTP definitely is able to instrumentalize that border and has been able to come into Afghanistan and across into Pakistan. But as Pakistan's frustration has grown, I think the accusations have become much more pointed. As you pointed out rightly, Pakistan has more recently began to accuse Kabul of not only tolerating the TTP, but also supporting it. And there's also more recently even accused the Taliban of supporting Baloch separatists, the Baloch Liberation Army, which primarily operates in southern Pakistan and Balochistan province.
Right, a whole different area of conflict.
Exactly. And recently, senior Pakistani politicians have even called the Taliban a proxy of India. So as frustration over the TTP has grown, I think the issue has metamorphosized into where I think the distrust has grown quite significantly, and the prospects of bridging the two sides has become much more difficult.
Are these attacks that happened overnight an escalation or just a continuation of this tit for tat?
So I think we've got a couple of important precedents. Firstly, Pakistan has made it quite clear that every time there's a serious security incident inside Pakistan by the TTP or other militants in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, they will retaliate by striking targets inside Afghanistan. Usually, Pakistan says they've targeted TTP or ISKP or other militants, and Afghanistan denies it, saying civilians have been targeted. The second precedent is the Taliban have now established a precedent where they respond to these airstrikes by carrying out attacks across the border. When that happens, Pakistan at times has felt that it needs to respond by carrying out airstrikes here in Kabul. And the rhetoric from the Afghan side, again, is to ratchet up and up the ante and try to do something more. So again, I think the challenge really is we're setting a precedent where neither side really knows how to back down from that and de-escalate.
So how much significance should we read into this comment on Twitter from Pakistan's defense minister that this is now open war? Is that a significant statement?
It's worth pointing out that the rhetoric on both sides has become quite polarizing, particularly since October last year. The Pakistani defense minister has made similar comments accusing the Taliban of being Indian proxies and whatnot. The rhetoric, it's interesting because the Pakistani media now almost unanimously calls the Taliban a Taliban regime, and the language is much more. And there's even talk of, you know, regime change in some Pakistani media circles. On the Afghan side, similarly, the rhetoric has become much more hardened. Pakistani government is often referred to as the military regime. The language is that the Pakistani military is trying to deflect from its own failures and its own troubles with, for example, the Imran Khan's PTI party by trying to scapegoat Afghanistan. So the rhetoric has become much more polarizing and much more antagonizing in a sense. But my hope is that saner minds are able to prevail. And despite the rhetoric, that at least when it comes to action, that we will not see a significant escalation.
Given all this back and forth, though, it sounds like a tense time to be in Kabul. What does it feel like on the ground there today?
While many Afghans might not be happy with the Taliban's control of the country, I think many appreciated the peace that the country is enjoying.
Interesting dichotomy there.
Exactly. And the worry for many Afghans would be, it almost feels surreal for many Afghans who have gone through nearly five decades of conflict, right? So I think the worry really in here, not only in Kabul, but across the country really is that, are we again towards the path towards a new set of conflict that would create, open another Pandora's box for the country?
Ibrahim Bahis is a senior analyst with Crisis Group. He spoke with me from Kabul. It has been a rough week for U.S.-Cuba relations. Earlier today, President Trump suggested to reporters that the U.S. is considering a friendly takeover of Cuba. The comments come on the heels of Wednesday's attack on a boat off of Cuba's coast. Cuba's Coast Guard fired on the vessel, killing four people and injuring six others. At least one of the passengers killed was a U.S. citizen. The boat was registered in Florida, and Cuba's Interior Ministry has accused the men aboard of attempting to infiltrate the island with, quote, terrorist ends. The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
What we know so far comes from what Cuban authorities have put out, that the men on the boat were carrying weapons, Molotov cocktails, and camouflage gear. The injured are being treated at a hospital in Cuba.
I don't remember something like this happening in a long time.
Jorge Duany teaches at Florida International University. He used to direct the Cuban Research Institute.
In the 1960s and 70s, it was quite common for Cuban exiles to try to go to Cuba and perhaps get involved in counter-revolutionary activities, sabotage, that kind of thing, but not in the last 10 or 15 years.
The timing of this, Duany says, coincides with the 30th anniversary of another incident. In February 1996, the Cuban military shot down two planes that belonged to a Florida humanitarian organization, killing four people. Yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was asked about this week's boat incident. Rubio is attending a summit with Caribbean leaders in St. Kitts and Nevis.
I'm not going to speculate now because right now, still, a lot of the information that's out there is information that's been provided by the Cubans. We are going to verify that information independently and reach our own conclusions.
Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants to the U.S. himself, has been a vocal supporter of regime change in Cuba. Last month, at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, he was asked if he would rule out U.S. regime change in Cuba.
Regime change?
Yes.
Oh, no, I think we would love to see the regime there change. We would like to. That doesn't mean that we're going to make a change, but we would love to see it change.
The U.S. government has been pressuring Cuban leaders, says Duany of Florida International University, and talks are on the way.
These are somewhat secret, although they're right now in the open, conversations between Secretary Rubio and the grandson of Raúl Castro, the former president of Cuba.
Cuban leaders are also watching what happened in Venezuela, says William Leo Grant. He teaches at the American University in Washington. Back in January, U.S. Special Forces entered Caracas and captured President Nicolas Maduro and his wife.
But Cuba is not Venezuela. The Cuban regime is much more coherent and institutionalized than the Venezuelan government was. And so it's not possible in the Cuban case to simply swoop in and abduct the president and fundamentally change the nature of the political system.
It's also unlikely that the Cuban armed forces would conduct a coup, Leo Grant says. Senior military leadership in Cuba rose through the ranks under the leadership of Raúl Castro, and people only got promoted if they were ideologically committed to the socialist project of the Cuban Revolution, he says.
So finding someone who is high enough up that they could command the loyalty of the armed forces and who is willing to essentially sell out the revolution and turn it over to the United States in such a highly nationalistic country seems like a very remote probability to me.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration has placed an oil embargo on Cuba. It has cut imports of Venezuelan oil to the island. This and the severe economic sanctions the U.S. has imposed on the country is leading to an unprecedented humanitarian crisis, says Leo Grant.
There's very little gasoline. Factories are shutting down. Hospitals are unable to provide basic care to patients. Schools are closing. The society is at the brink of a real collapse because you can't run a modern society without fuel.
The U.S. Treasury said on Wednesday that it will allow some sale of Venezuela's oil to Cuban companies. This will be a limited policy change, not a wholesale open market for the Cuban government, it said. For the World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Coming up, how musicians get through wartime.
This is a voice of our protection, of our defense, of our powerful. This is our weapons.
We'll hear about a new music project from Ukraine. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Since Russia started occupying Ukrainian land back in 2014, an estimated 20 to 30,000 children have been abducted from occupied territories and sent into Russia. That is something singer Mariska Marzuk and a flautist named Lisa are drawing attention to. They both perform under just their first names, and their new project is called Daughters of Donbas, Songs of Stolen Children. Brendan O'Shea reports.
It was February 2022 when Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, 4 years later, one Ukrainian musician is confronting one of the least visible crimes of the war, the mass abduction of children from occupied territories. Thousands of Ukrainian children have been taken from their homes, transferred across borders and absorbed into Russian institutions. Many have their names, language and identity erased. In response, the singer, composer and journalist Mariska has created a music project called Daughters of Donbas, Songs of Stolen Children. Mariska is also a mother of four and a recipient of the Amnesty International Peace Prize. For her, music is not an escape from politics, it's a direct response to it.
I am Ukrainian, and no matter where I live in my life, I will always be Ukrainian. And everything that happened in my land with my people, it will always be in my heart, and it always will be priority for me. It's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Daughters of Donbas is a contemporary acoustic project rooted in Ukrainian folk traditions, chamber songwriting, and testimony. At its center are two musicians. One is Mariska herself. The other is Lisa, a 19-year-old flautist and folk instrumentalist who performs without her surname. Lisa was 16 when she was abducted from the besieged city of Mariupol. As a teenager, she kept diaries. The following excerpts from her diary are voiced by someone else.
December 27. This is the best winter of my life. Today was our second and biggest concert. I feel like a real rock star.
After the bombing began in February 2022, Lisa and her family were forced into a basement shelter.
We prayed and wept, asking God not to start a war. But it was too late. The war had already come to our home.
By March, Mariupol was encircled.
I don't understand why they want to destroy us. I feel very sorry for the children and the newborns. Why do they deserve this?
When her home was destroyed, Lisa walked 17 kilometers with a guitar on her back, trying to escape the city. At one checkpoint, she encountered Russian soldiers. They offered sweets and canned food. Some people cried with gratitude. Soon after, she was taken to refugee camps in the Donetsk region, sleeping on cardboard and rags, surrounded by wounded people. Her escape from deportation was organized by a network of volunteers operating across borders. Lisa now lives in Germany. The war is no longer around her, but it has not left her. Lisa says her experience of abduction showed her how fragile freedom is and how quickly a human life can be reduced to fear and uncertainty. When the full-scale invasion came, Lisa says it took more than her home.
Until the war, I felt like super harmonized with all the world and all the people around. I was so kind. I was so happy. I was playing in music every single day. I couldn't spend a day without playing music. I realized that they took something more than my home and my heart or my homeland. They took something that was lighting up everything around me, because I don't feel like I need it anymore, because they took something that made sense of all of it.
In 1930, Soviet authorities executed Ukrainian folk musicians en masse, recognizing the danger of songs that carried news, memory, and identity. Daughters of Donbass revives that tradition deliberately.
Can you imagine the voices of our ancestors that holding everything that they lived through for 1,000 years? So this is a voice of our protection, of our defense, of our powerful. This is our weapons that we able to use on now times.
For this project, Marishka searched for poetry that could speak to the stolen children.
I remember the story that I sing a lullaby in abandoned train station in Donbass. I was standing at the empty hall. It was like singing quietly because acoustic was so good there. So I was singing lullaby like to myself. And then like one soldier came out and he was standing quietly and listening that and crying. He says like, Marichka, I didn't know you were a singer. So, and then I found later that he was killed by Russians in a month after that. And I realized that was the last song I sang to him. The last song he heard in his life was my lullaby.
For Marishka, performance is inseparable from lived experience. For Lisa, it can open wounds, but remaining silent feels worse.
I'm not doing it for a hype. I'm not doing it for fun. I do it for my story, to share it with the world, to ask the world to not turn around about it, because not everyone could say. So many people is dead, so many people is deported, and they are still silent.
Daughters of Donbass has gained international attention. The group have just completed a tour of the UK and will perform this year in Australia. And in April, they will present the program in The Hague, the city where the International Criminal Court has issued an indictment against Russian President Vladimir Putin over the alleged abduction of Ukrainian children. This is Brendan O'Shea in Berlin.
Brendan reported this story for DW's Inside Europe podcast. Daughters of Donbass just released their debut album. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Nigeria, chatbots are providing mental health services with the idea that they can provide some care and connect patients to human support when they need it. That's filling a healthcare gap in a country with fewer than 300 psychiatrists. Taiwo James Obindo is past president of the Association of Psychiatrists in Nigeria. I asked him about the symptoms people are bringing to these chatbots.
Well, some may go there and ask. I've not been able to sleep. My heart is racing, and some of the symptoms, maybe of anxiety disorders or symptoms of depression. Some also may go there to look for support. What can I do? So some may also look for a referral.
And what kind of responses are these chatbots able to provide? Can they help in all of those use cases that you just outlined?
Well, for some of us, we know that the AI is a function of the information that it's been loaded with.
Sure.
Quite a number of situations have been wrongly diagnosed, and then some of them have been directed. I call them charlatans.
Charlatans.
They call themselves emotional motivators and all that because they have presence in the social media.
So sometimes these apps, you're saying, refer people to healthcare providers who are just on social media and maybe don't have any qualifications or not the right qualifications. Are there apps that are doing good?
Well, of course, I believe that there are apps that are doing well, and then they are really complementing what we have and then filling the gap that we have.
You mentioned this gap. Of course, I referenced that figure that comes from your organization that Nigeria has 230 million people, more than that, and fewer than 300 psychiatrists. Why is there such a gap in mental health care providers there?
We are now having a migration of mental health practitioners out of 5 trained psychiatrists, 3 will leave within the first 6 months of their qualification. Also, most of those who have the qualifications will prefer to stay in this urban area. So the majority of those who have mental health conditions who live in the rural area do not have access to the right kind of treatment also.
Why are all these psychiatrists and mental health professionals leaving Nigeria? Is it a matter of pay or working conditions?
We often look at it in 2 major ways. There is a pull and there is a push. A pull has to do with better environment, better remunerations, and all that environment, access to care for the family and all in the developed world.
Remuneration meaning pay.
Pay, the salary, the allowances, even the environment we work in, the materials we need to work with. In the last 6 months, we've not had an ECT machine in my facility.
What kind of machine?
Electroconvulsive therapy machine. ECT.
So that's shock therapy?
Yeah, well, that's what they used to call it.
Okay.
We still make use of it. And you feel frustrated. The patient needs this, and you cannot offer them the kind of help that they would need. Those are factors that are influencing people moving abroad. This is pushing them out. The good environment out there is pulling them over there.
And it sounds like you say that these AI chatbots that we started the conversation with can be maybe part of a solution, can help refer people to care, but they can also cause harm. Do you think there is a better, more sustainable way to help improve access to mental health care in Nigeria?
Improving the budgetary allocation to mental health care in the country will also help making facilities available, making the environment more conducive to management and treatment also will be good. Of course, the issue of the chatbots is also very, very important in the sense that people can seek help, seek second opinion, but that needs to be regulated.
Taiwo James Obindo is a past president of Nigeria's Association of Psychiatrists. 40 hours is considered the standard work week here in the U.S. In certain jobs, when you work more, you are legally entitled to overtime pay. In Mexico, the legal standard has been a 48-hour week, leaving just a one-day weekend. But Mexican politicians have just approved a plan to gradually bring it down to 40. As the world's Tubi Saizea reports from Mexico City, many say the new law still falls short.
Angel Castellanos is rushing into a government labor office in Mexico City.
Estamos yendo para la Junta Local de Conciliación y Arbitraje. Yo estoy yendo ahorita para una audiencia.
He's been in a legal fight with his former employer for 4 years, and he's heading to the labor board because he has a hearing today.
Nos redujeron el 30% de nuestro salario.
He says during the pandemic, the company cut wages by 30% and increased hours on the staff who remained.
Llegué a trabajar hasta 12, 13 horas al día. Jamás me pagaron una hora extra.
I worked up to 12 or 13 hours a day, he says, and he was never paid for overtime. In Mexico, it's illegal to reduce salaries, and overtime must be paid. But enforcing the law can take years. Castellanos says the stress left him burned out, and he joined a national movement pushing to shorten Mexico's work week. As a sign of progress, this week the Mexican Congress approved a long-awaited reform. Starting in January, it will lower the work week from 48 hours to 40, gradually by 2030. But Castellanos says the change falls short.
Básicamente seguimos teniendo solo un día de descanso, en lugar de los dos, que eran el espíritu original de la reforma.
Basically, we still only have one day of rest, he says, instead of the two that were originally promised. Plus, the reform increases overtime allowance from 9 to 12 hours a week. That means many workers could still end up working sometimes over 50 hours a week. Castellanos also complains that the reform spreads the reduction too slowly, just a couple of hours less each year until it reaches 40 hours a week in 2030. The long hours culture in Mexico has deep roots, says Viri Rios. She's the founder and editor of the newsletter Mexico Decoded.
The Mexican model designed by policymakers in the 90s was aimed to position Mexico as a cheap manufacturing of American products. This basically meant that they promoted low wages and very long hours.
But this model hasn't delivered strong growth, she says. Mexicans work some of the longest hours in the industrialized world, and productivity remains low. Rios cited research suggesting that longer work weeks actually reduce productivity, especially when workers have so little time to rest.
The goal of the petition is and has always been to have 2 days off. It was changed last minute because the government was lobbied by business interests.
She says inequality shapes how time off is distributed in Mexico because many people with college degrees work 5 days, 40 hours a week. But for millions of others, that second day of rest is still out of reach.
The fact that only blue-collar workers have one day off is, I would say, caste system, a form of discrimination that's only possible because of the profound inequality that Mexico has learned to tolerate over centuries.
Business groups support cutting the work week, but they oppose abrupt changes.
The gradual implementation or transition period is not about delay, but about sustainability.
Oscar de la Vega Castillo, a labor consultant, says cutting 8 hours overnight would sharply increase labor costs, and this could have an impact on small businesses.
If the implementation lacks flexibility, companies, mainly micro, small, and medium-sized business, could struggle to comply with the new law and then could migrate toward informal arrangements.
He says the risk for employers is layoffs or more jobs moving into Mexico's vast informal economy, with cash payments, under-the-table transactions, and fewer protections for workers. Francisco Martinez, who leads the Mexican Association of Human Capital Companies, says the reform is a good first step.
Yo creo que es un primer paso y no descarto que en un futuro se pueda conseguir los 2 días de descanso. Pero
he says eventually workers could have 2 days of rest. But for a reform of this scale to succeed in Mexico, it has to move one step at a time, he says. Back outside the labor office, Angel Castellanos tells me enforcing labor rights in Mexico can take years, and many workers give up. The hardest part, he says, is getting the authorities to do their job and move the process along. Because laws may change, but without enforcement, he says, workers remain vulnerable. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Turkey is in its worst drought of the last 50 years. Cities like Ankara and Istanbul are now shutting off the water overnight. In Izmir, the country's third biggest city, the rain has returned. But after several dry years, officials and scientists warn the relief is not likely to last. Ben Derico visited Izmir to see how the region is planning for a future where access to water may be less certain.
Breakfast time at Zeno Gevrek, a bakery in Izmir's central Alsancak neighborhood, is always busy. Customers sip tea, shout orders, and tear into freshly baked simit, a sesame-covered ring-shaped bread that's a Turkish breakfast staple. A bakery runs on water, the dough, the dishes, countless cups of tea. And even though rain has finally started falling again, the reservoirs that supply Izmir's drinking water are still critically low. The Tatila Dam, which usually supplies somewhere around half of the city's water, is currently under 35% full, after dipping below 1% at the end of last year. Between a long line of customers and an army of bakers is Muzaffer, a lifelong Izmir resident who's worked here for decades. In between orders, I asked Muzaffer if he's worried about running out of water at the bakery sometime soon. He tells me he's not concerned. He's been hearing that the reservoirs have started filling up again. In fact, he says he doesn't think there will be a water problem much longer, because much of Turkey has seen snow this winter. Normally, reservoirs refilling is a good sign. But Alper Baba, head of the International Water Resources Department at the Izmir Technical Institute, says the rain that's falling may not be enough to sustain Izmir into the future.
You know, if you look at 100-year data, meteorological data, data say that the temperature is going to increase, precipitation going to be decreased in this region.
Izmir has already started to see this. Last summer, temperatures averaged above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The heat made a long-running drought worse. To manage water consumption, Mayor Cemal Tugay implemented rolling water cuts, shutting off taps across the city nightly from 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. But when I visited in January with the cuts in full effect in the city center, few seemed to experience any kind of interruption. I popped into businesses and spoke with residents, and many said by the time they needed water in the morning, it was back on. Still, even with the reservoirs dangerously low, the water was flowing. The reason why, experts say, could spell problems for the future.
We as a human race are the one species that really relies on groundwater.
This is John Selker, professor of hydrology at Oregon State University and a specialist in groundwater systems.
What we can see is that in a place dry as Turkey, the amount of net water coming to replenish the aquifers is of the order of an inch a year. Whereas you can easily draw out many, many feet of water a year.
While their reservoirs are low, Izmir is leaning heavily on groundwater, rapidly pumping stores that can take years, even decades, to fill or recharge.
So the danger of groundwater consumption is that you can overshoot, meaning you get used to having a certain amount of water that you can drink every day, but then the water level is going down and down and down and down and down. And then after a few decades, you don't have any water at all.
This is the gamble. Fill gaps to satiate the thirst of 5 million people now or prepare for the future and save their long-term stores. Both Selker and Baba agree that human consumption must go down. But they say a stronger focus must be put on industrial and agricultural groundwater use. In Turkey, an estimated 90% of groundwater is used for irrigated agriculture. And about an hour north of Izmir in the farm town of Menemen, many are already beginning to struggle to find water. At a busy farmer's market in the center of town, I spoke with a young farmer named Sumeyye, selling vegetables at her family's stall. She told me people here used to rely on irrigation canals.
In the past, there used to be more water in the canals from rainwater. But now, since the canal water has decreased, we're having difficulties irrigating. So we irrigate with groundwater. But because we have to pay electricity to pump, we spend a lot more.
Even when they can pay, though, many here can often find wells run dry as the water table moves further and further down. Sumeya says between the cost to pump groundwater and the rising prices of seed and fertilizer, some farmers here have stopped planting altogether.
The field next to ours planted cotton. The field didn't have groundwater access. So when the canal water ended or got low, they didn't irrigate and they didn't plant that field again.
Sumeya says her family is planting less now, just to stay afloat while she finishes nursing school. After that, she says her mother will likely close the farm. The struggle to secure drinking water may be playing out now in Turkey, but hydrologist John Selker says this is a global issue.
You're going to eventually reduce irrigated water use. That's all there is to it. There's just not enough water in Turkey to irrigate any crop you want for as much land area as you want. It's easy for me to say, now they've got to figure out how to change it. Every indication is that we're going to hit the wall before we climb over it.
Back in Izmir, reservoir levels are looking better than they did back in January. But Mayor Tugay says he's working to find additional water sources. He's suggested the region try cloud seeding, or making artificial rain. And his office says they've applied for permits to build 3 desalination plants. Even with the concern about the future of water here, the city officially ended the water cuts in early February, citing higher reservoir levels. But while winter rains have been able to bring the water level back up some, if this summer is anywhere near as hot as last summer was, experts say water stores may not be enough to last through the end of the year. For The World, I'm Ben DiRico.
Ahead, some good news for the environment. For that, we will go to Italy. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. To live in southern Italy is to get comfortable with ash. All that ash, and there is a lot of it, comes from Europe's most active volcano, Mount Etna. Mario Pagliaro is research director for Italy's National Resource Council. He says for generations, people in the area have used the ash as fertilizer. Now, the rest of the world is catching on to ash, or tephra, as it's called there, and it's become a commodity for the region. I spoke with Pagliaro about that today. He started by describing the eruptions themselves.
The larger particles, the heavier particles, come first, and after that, the tiny parts deposit, and the process can last hours or even days. It is very disturbing for the population in the beginning, but eventually everyone knows volcanic ash brings fertility to land, and therefore people do not complain too much.
Right. So you mentioned that despite the disruption this ash might bring, people aren't too bothered about it because they know it brings fertility to the agricultural areas that surround Mount Etna. Why is volcanic ash such an effective fertilizer?
It is such an effective fertilizer because it fertilizes not directly growing plants, let's say, but the enzymes, the bacteria that are in the soil. That's the mechanism is you feed the bacteria and the enzymes, which are catalytic molecules that contain metals. These metals are called, for example, iron or manganese or copper. And the tephra is full of these micro elements. Therefore, it is extremely effective. Not only it fertilizes the soil, but the quality of the crops, from potatoes to wheat, from orchards to lemons to fruits, wines coming from this area, that are even more expensive.
So you're saying that volcanic ash, which has a lot of minerals in it, is good for the enzymes that help crops grow specifically?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And, this is the mechanism. Therefore, people can use it, can even sell it. There are companies that pack this volcanic ash and they can sell it now. It is not expensive. It is easily stored. You don't need any special equipment to store, even for years, the ash, because it's a mineral. The results were very successful, and new companies purchased the material, and now awareness is spreading rapidly, also thanks to the internet.
How recent are those changes?
For example, a few years ago, 6-7 years ago already, companies were packing the material and selling it, and they started first with relatively small bags of 20 kilograms, and now there are deliveries that are made by lorries, because again, it's readily transported, it is completely safe material. It is only harmful for breathing when the particles are very small. Otherwise, it's not harmful at all.
Oh, interesting. So is Catania becoming like a big export market for volcanic ash? Is this changing life for the people in the area?
I would say more than Catania, the island of Sicily. The volcano is huge. It spans a huge area. Catania is just the largest city. And as I said, it would be a gift from Sicily for Europe, from the rest of the world, to receive this material and start to use it.
You mentioned that it's not safe to breathe in this ash. Was there ever a concern among scientists that it might not actually be good to put it on crops that are then eaten? And has that changed at all in recent years?
Yes, it is. There was a concern about the amount of heavy metals, for example, lead or chromium, but the amounts measured in this case by chemists in Spain, they found in this plantation of bananas that the amounts were well below the threshold of danger. Therefore, this is one of the few cases in which there are really no negative or potentially negative effects. We only have positive effects, and the material is hugely, widely abundant across the world. So people just should start to use it.
Is there a risk of receiving too much ash in the area, either for agricultural use or it just becoming too much of a nuisance for folks who live there?
Yes, yes. There is this risk when the eruption is too big and the amount of ash is, for example, it can even reach the height of several tenths of centimeters. Of course, land will suffer, the crops will die because they will not receive light and oxygen any longer. But besides those cases of exceptional long-lasting eruptions, the area is benefiting much more than it is, let's say, being hurt by these frequent eruptions.
Mario Pagliaro is the research director at Italy's National Resource Council. Finally today, it is Pokemon's 30th birthday. The first two video games in the iconic franchise were released on this date in Japan in 1996. Since then, Pokemon has grown into a global phenomenon spanning dozens of video games, 24 movies, and a TV show with more than 1,300 episodes. Not to mention the seemingly endless supply of trading cards, toys, and children's books, all united by that classic slogan, "Gotta catch 'em all." Pokemon! You might remember this song from Saturday mornings. It is the original theme song from the TV series that started airing in the U.S. in 1999. It introduced the world to Ash Ketchum and his faithful companion, a yellow mouse with red circles on its cheeks.
Pikachu!
Its name is Pikachu.
Oh, it's so cute, it's the best of all!
You'll see.
Oh, hi, Pikachu!
It was the summer of 2016 when Pokemon became more interactive and maybe addictive. That's when the game Pokemon Go launched, using GPS and smartphone maps to let players catch their favorite creatures in their own neighborhoods, make the creatures battle, or trade them with friends. Catching every single Pokemon is a monumental task these days. There were only 151 species in the first video games. Now there are 1,025 and counting. All of them adorable in their own unique ways. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. You can also catch our original reporting on YouTube. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend.
Is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.